commanded in Exodus 20:14, thou shall not commit adultery. This will be the seventh commandment, part 5. As has already been pointed out on a couple of occasions, this is somewhat of a ticklish subject to address without being offensive. And furthermore, it is not the easiest subject to bring a little humor into. In other words, it's difficult to tell a joke about this subject without being vulgar or crude. In fact, I've found that nearly all jokes concerning this area of life are, and I didn't say all, but nearly all, are a transgression of Ephesians 4, what we find in Ephesians 4 and verse 29, and also Ephesians 5, 3, and 4. Let me just share those with you. You won't need to turn to them. Where in Ephesians 4:29 it says, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear. And notice it says, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth. And then the opposite side is, guard your words, and whatever you say, let it be full of grace, so that it would be full of grace to those who hear. And then as a follow-up to that in Ephesians 5, verses 3 and 4, it says, but do not let immorality, and of course that is what we're specifically dealing with in this particular series, it says, but do not let immorality or any impurity or greed even be named among you, as is proper among the saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. And with those admonitions in mind, let me take the opportunity, a little bit off, although out of the heart the mouth speaketh, and it's out of the heart we're told in the Gospels that precede adulteries and murder and fornication and all of these other things, so it's not that far off base. But with those admonitions from Ephesians 4 and Ephesians 5 in mind, let me take the opportunity to admonish those of you, especially those of you who use the Internet. I don't know what it is about the Internet. You know, it's something that God has given us as a great tool to witness, that's not the word either, but that's a better one than your dad's. But anyway, to witness and to reach out with the message of the gospel. But there's so much that on the Internet, as anybody who knows, that is just so foul and so immoral. And there's something about those who use the Internet that they use it in such a way, or do things with it, I've found, and not everyone, I'm talking about only in certain cases, but it's almost like it's a license to do things that they wouldn't normally do. Not only in maybe going to places on the web that they shouldn't be visiting, but also in things that they forward. Let me admonish again those, especially on the Internet, as Christians, or let me put it this way, as ambassadors of Christ, in many instances, we have no business passing on what so often non-Christians, the non-Christian world finds amusing. And by some of what I've seen forwarded by some Christians, some of you ought to be ashamed of your standards. Our standards in all areas of life, not only in our actions, but in the way that we speak and in everything else that we do, should not be assessed according to the world standards. That is to say, just so long as they're better than the world standards, just as long as we're a cut above the world, we're okay. That is not how we should judge our words and our actions. Instead, our standards should be governed, should be determined by Yahweh's standards, period. We are to be, or at least striving to be, aren't we told to do this, to be as holy as He is holy? Now, there aren't any of us that's attained that yet. Or as perfect, it also says, as He is perfect. But that is our goal. That is what we should be striving for in everything that we do. And especially us. You know, our gospel is so maligned. As it was in the first century with Paul. And he said he reminded his readers in certain places in his epistles, he said, let there be nothing. Bad enough, they're going to accuse us. You know, in that day and age, they accuse them of almost everything under the sun, just like they are today. And he says, but whatever you do, don't let them find anything in your life that they can legitimately blame you for. And no, we're not holy as He is holy, and we're not perfect as He is perfect, but boy, we should be striving to be as holy as He is holy and as perfect as He is perfect. We are to be lights in a dark world, and not just dim lights, or dim-witted lights, but we are to be bright lights in a very dark world. People should be able to see us and say, wow, there's something over there. It's so dark everywhere else, and here's this beam of light that's shining back and saying, wait a minute, there's something different here from everything else. And we are to avoid even the appearance of evil. Is this a rebuke? Yes, it is, for those who need to hear it. And it's also a challenge to say, hey, don't forget, these are the admonitions of the Scriptures. That's the goal. That's the cut above everything else that all of us should be striving for. In that light, let me tell you that it is nearly impossible to find an appropriate joke to use in this area of life. In fact, I didn't find one. I intended to find something to lighten the subject up a little, but I couldn't come up with anything that was appropriate for Christians. Nevertheless, this fruitless endeavor, has provided me to admonish all of us to be careful that we don't allow our standards to be dictated by the world or to be deluded by the world. You know, just that cut above where the world is at. Let us be reminded of that. Now, on to the subject at hand. Sorry, I don't have any joke. Couldn't find one. There was a couple that I knew of that I had in some books, some joke books that I sometimes refer to that were close, but I just couldn't bring myself to use any of them. Now, so let's go on to the subject at hand. Let's take our Bibles and turn to Leviticus 18 again. Leviticus chapter 18. We left off in the last message with Leviticus 18 and verse 20, which says again, moreover, thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife to defile thyself with her. This verse depicts the sin that most people would describe as or limit adultery to, that is, to sexual relations with someone other than your spouse. However, once again, this is clearly only one statute that explains or elaborates upon the seventh commandment or upon what adultery is in its entirety. Keep in mind that Leviticus 18 is where we're at. Keep in mind that anything that sexually debases, spoils, or substitutes, or adulterates Yahweh's design for a husband and his wife's physical relationship is adultery or a seventh commandment violation. Anything that adulterates how God designed for a husband and wife and their relationship to exist. Thus far, that is through verse 20, Leviticus 18 has addressed prohibitions against incest, relations during a woman's cycle, and marital infidelity as it is usually thought of, as I just read to you again in verse 20. Later in this same chapter, beginning with verse 22, just two verses later, Leviticus 18 addresses prohibitions against sodomy and bestiality, all of which clearly pertain to sexual improprieties or acts that defile the marriage bed. But right smack dab in the middle of all of that, we have verse 21. Up to verse 20, it's dealing with sexual transgressions, and verse 22 through 23 at least, it also deals with sexual improprieties. But in the middle of that, we have verse 21. Let's read it together. Verse 21, and thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech, and neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am Yahweh. Now, nearly everyone interprets that particular verse as pertaining to idolatry. But doesn't it seem just a little bit odd that a chapter devoted to sexual taboos in a chapter that's devoted to sexual taboos, that Yahweh would throw in a statement about idolatry. Specifically, child sacrifice. Did I say child sacrifice? Well, maybe it's not so odd after all. That is, if we interpret child sacrifice correctly. Maybe this isn't a verse out of place as it first appears to be in this particular passage. Let's look at this verse more closely. To begin with, note that the two words, the fire, is in italics in verse 21, and indicating that those two words are not found in the original manuscripts. They were added by the translators. Now, that is not to say, so take fire out, and we may have something, or the fire out, those two words that are in italics, and we may have something completely different than what we would have in other cases. Now, that is not to say that Moloch worship or Moloch idolatry didn't sometimes entail child sacrifice of this kind, that is literally burning children alive. And that aspect of Moloch worship is addressed in other places where fire is included in those passages. However, that is not what is being addressed here in Leviticus 18 and in Leviticus verse 20 where we find the, and we'll be going there in just a minute, Leviticus 20 where we find the judgments for these same transgressions listed in Leviticus 18. And the words, the fire, again, don't belong in this verse. In other words, there is more than one way to offer your seed or your offspring to Molech. And although this verse appears to be out of place when interpreted as it usually is, I believe you'll see and we'll see that it is not out of place at all when it's understood correctly. So let's proceed and let's look at this particular verse a little bit closer. Let's proceed by examining first the judgment for this statute. Turn to Leviticus chapter 20 now, and beginning with verse 1. Now, they're not the sins that are listed in Leviticus 18. The statutes that we find there for the seventh commandment are, we find the judgments again in Leviticus 20, but not in the same order, but they're pretty much all addressed here in Leviticus 20. Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 1, it says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Again thou shalt say to the children of Israel, Whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones." Now note first, that before we continue, that the phrase, the fire, is absent in the judgment for this sin, as it should have been in Leviticus 18 and verse 21 as well. Here in Leviticus 20, it's just, quote, giveth, and the word any doesn't have to be there either, giveth of his seed, or his offspring, it might be translated in the New American Standard, giveth of his seed unto Molech. That's all it is. Not giveth his seed, or not passes through the fire. It's just giveth, think about it, just he who giveth his seed unto Molech. And that's the first clue as to what is being addressed in Leviticus 20 and 18 and verse 21. Continuing with Leviticus 20. Again, verse 2, "Again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. And I will set my face against that man, and will cut him out from among his people, because he has given of his seed unto Molech, to defile my sanctuary, and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do any ways hide their eyes from the man, when he giveth of his seed unto Molech, and kill him not, then I will set my face against that man, and against his family, and will cut him off, and all that go a-whoring after him, to commit whoredom with Molech from among their people." Now, note also, in this dialogue, or in this judgment for the same sin, note the words whoring and whoredom with Molech. The New American Standard translates it as playing the harlot. The NIV uses the word prostitution in its translation, which are all indicative of sexual misconduct, either figuratively or literally. You know, chapter 18, verse 21, in and of itself, you just read it without digging a little bit deeper, and it appears it's just dealing with idolatry. But do note that in this judgment for the sin, it specifically uses the Hebrew word that they translate whoredom or whoring. Now, this particular passage, which again are indicative of some kind of sexual misconduct, either figuratively or literally. Now, this particular passage is not addressing Israel's whoredom as a people as a whole by just simply going after other gods, but instead individual whoredom of some kind with Molech. Or if you will permit me at this point, whoredom, harlotry, or prostitution with who or what Molech represents. Therefore, the whoredom spoken of in this instance is certainly more likely to be literal whoredom, rather, since we're talking about individual transgressions among the people, rather than figurative harlotry, as it would be if it was speaking of Israel's transgression of a people away from her God. Now, let's return back to Leviticus 18. Leviticus 20 ties it in with whoredom and whoring, and does not use through fire as Leviticus 18:21 shouldn't have. Let's return to Leviticus 18. Let me read verse 21 again to you, eliminating the words "the fire" in italics. And it says, "And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through to Molech, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am Yahweh." Our third clue as to what sexual impropriety is being addressed in this particular verse is found in the phrase "pass through," or at least in the Hebrew word and its definition by the lexicographers, that is translated in the King James as "pass through." Strong's Concordance defines it in the following sense. It says, quote, "a primitive route to cross over used very widely of any transition, literal or figurative, transitive, intransitive, intensive, causative." In other words, it's a term that's used in a lot of different ways. But then Strong's ends by saying, specifically, to cover in copulation. End of quote. The new Brown Driver Briggs Jacinius Hebrew English lexicon agrees with Strong's in that same regard. It, of course, deals with it in a very broad sense. And then at one point, Jacinius, what's normally just reduced to Jacinius' lexicon, points us to Job chapter 21. Keeping your finger in Leviticus, you might want to turn to Job 21 or listen as I get to it. Job points us to Job 21 as an example. Job 21 in verse 10 specifically. In other words, it uses Job 21:10 as an example of this word being used with sexual connotations. Job 21 in verse 10, where it says, Verse 10, "their bull gendereth," King James, "and faileth not, their cow calveth, and casteth not her calf." The word "gendereth" there, the bull gendereth, the word "gendereth" is the same Hebrew word, abar, that's translated as "pass through" in Genesis 18 and verse 21. The New American Standard translates that verse, probably a little clearer for us in this, in the 21st century, as "his ox mates without fail, his cow calves and does not abort." Something a farmer, you know, or a rancher, that's what he wants. He wants bulls that are going to mate without fail and produce a calf, and cows that won't abort their calf somewhere along the line. But the word "mates" is the word that's talking about, that comes or is translated from the Hebrew word "abar." The new NIV is even a little bit more blunt about it and uses the word "breed," that the bull breeds without fail. Same word, so don't miss that. But we have a biblical, at least one biblical example, where that word "abar" is specifically used in relation to some kind of, or at least it has sexual implications. You know, we may not yet completely understand what is being referred to in Leviticus 18:21, but it's now beginning to look like verse 21 of Leviticus 18 fits with the rest of this chapter that addresses sexual transgressions. So, just what is this verse referring to? How could someone commit literal whoredom or adultery with Moloch, a false god or an idol? Well, whereas the sin appears to be literal, Moloch certainly must represent something else. Well, guess what, people? Moloch was the chief god of the Ammonites, one of the three forbidden lineages, incestual lineages that we already spoke of early in this chapter. Now, incest has already been covered in this chapter. So, this must be dealing with some other sexual aberration other than incest. They were just the result of incest. It didn't necessarily continue. But Moloch was the chief god of those people. Could it be that Moloch represents those people and other peoples like them that were forbidden for Israel to have relations with? Well, the fact that the Ammonites were the forbidden lineage, a forbidden lineage, provides us with what is probably the final clue in this particular verse. What we have in Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 21 is a Hebrew idiom. And the Old Testament is full of Hebrew idioms that so often in the 20th and 21st centuries we want to take literally and make a literal application out of them, and thus we come up with the wrong conclusions. We have in English thousands upon thousands of Hebrew idioms. I didn't think of coming up with one, if somebody can think of one real quick, that where we say one thing and mean something entirely different. The Hebrew is full of things like that. You're going to the dogs. You know, does that mean you're going to go look for a dog? Are you going to go visit the dog pound? No. It means you're just letting yourself go to pieces, some negative fashion. You're going to the dogs. That's just one. That just comes off the top of my head. We'd come up with hundreds and thousands of them if we took the time to do so. The Hebrew is the same way. Every language is the same way. This is obviously a Hebrew idiom, a prohibition against forbidden lineage relationships and by extension against interracial relationships, because either one was and is still likely to lead to idolatry or the worship of false god. And furthermore, either one also mingles or pollutes the genes of Israel or any other race, for that matter, as at least in Israel's regard, as Ezra put it in the book of Ezra. And so there's a dual reason. Not only that it often leads, and more often than not does lead, to the worship of the god of the people that one mixes with, but also it pollutes the genes. It adulterizes. It mixes the genes of two different peoples. Now, you do not have to take my word on this interpretation of Leviticus 18:21, and I don't want you to either. So let me provide you with some other witnesses to this interpretation. In his book, The Old Testament Light, The Indispensable Guide to the Customs, Manners, and Idioms of Biblical Times, George Lanza corroborates these conclusions. Here's what he says. Quote, seed in this instance in Leviticus 18:21 means semen, or it may just mean offspring, but he comes to the same conclusion. The Eastern text reads, you shall not let any of your semen be cast into a strange non-Israel or strange woman, meaning non-Israelite, to cause her to be pregnant. This ordinance is against cohabiting with pagan women, or non-Israelite women, because this was directed, of course, specifically to the Israelites. Furthermore, in his translation of the Bible, Lamza translated Leviticus 18:21 in the following fashion. You shall not let any of your semen be cast into a strange woman to cause her to be pregnant, neither shall you profane the name of your God, I am Yahweh. Also, consider Jubilee's testimony. Now, the book of Jubilees, some people put far more stock and regard into the book of Jubilees than I will. But it's a first century. It's pretty much pretty well been established to be a first century. The author of the book, or it was authored in the first century, late first century A.D. And although I don't certainly don't put it anywhere close to the authority of the scriptures, it does provide sometimes the perspective of the people that were much closer to the time of Leviticus 18 and other passages in the Old Testament than we are today. So let me share it with you. Jubilees chapter 30, verses 6 through 12. It says, quote, If there is any man in Israel who desires to give his daughter or his sister to any man who is of the seed of the Gentiles, of course, Gentiles throughout this particular passage, of course, is referring to anyone non-Israelite. It says, if there is any man, be it non-Israelite, at least in the context of the scriptures, anyone non-Israelite from the forbidden lineages or of other races. If there is any man in Israel who desires to give his daughter or his sister to any man who is of the seed of the Gentiles, he shall surely die. For he has committed a sin and a shame in Israel. And to this law there is no limit of days, and no ceasing and no forgiveness, but he shall be rooted out who defiles his daughter among all Israel, because he has given of his seed to Moloch. So he defines what giving your seed to Moloch is before he ever even uses the term. A little bit later, and thou, Moses, command the children of Israel and testify over them that they shall not give any of their daughters to the Gentiles, and that they shall not take any of the daughters of the Gentiles, for this is a curse before the Lord. And it is disgraceful to Israel, to those that give and to those that receive from any Gentiles any daughters, for it is unclean and a curse to Israel, and Israel will not be clean of this uncleanness of him who has of the daughters of the Gentiles for a wife, and who has given of his daughters to a man who is any of the seed of the Gentiles. End of that quote. Furthermore, here's another witness. Under the heading Moloch, Cult of, the Encyclopedia Judaica, volume 12 on page 232, provides additional corroboration for this interpretation. Quote, the book of Jubilees, so it's going back here to Jubilees, verse chapter 30 and verse 7 and following, connects intermarriage, or rather the marrying off of one's children to pagans, again speaking of non-Israelites, with the sin of Moloch. This tradition seems to be echoed in the dissenting opinion of Rabbi Ishmael, cross-reference, and he gives that, and Sephrai Deuteronomy 18, who explains the prohibition of Moloch as the impregnation of a pagan woman, an interpretation lying behind the Syriac translation in Leviticus 18 and 20. The common denominator of all of these traditions is the understanding of Moloch worship as the transfer of Jewish, and of course what they should have had, what is more correct, Israelite, children to paganism, listen to this, either by delivering them directly to the pagan priest for sacrifice, or, and I added for sacrifice in that case, but that's what's implied in this quote, or by procreation through intercourse with a pagan woman. This tradition, which could hardly be an invention, is now corroborated by the evidence in the Assyrian documents. End of quote. So not only do they provide information themselves, but they refer to the Syriac translation and even to the Assyrian documents that also document the same from a much closer date to Leviticus 18, when Moses wrote Leviticus 18, than we are today. In other words, according to this, there's more, as I pointed out, there is more than one way to offer your offspring to Moloch. One, to give them to be sacrificed in fire, or one, to mix with those peoples and bear offspring that are mixed, and that thus are given over to those people rather than remaining with their own people. The Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 7, page 611, under the heading Intermarriage, provides this, quote, in the book of Jubilees, intermarriage with all Gentiles is prohibited. No allowances being made for proselytes. Now that's often the point that many people want to, many Christians today want to say is that, hey, the only reason for this was because to keep them from getting involved in idolatry. But according to the first century A.D. book of Jubilees,
It didn't matter whether they were proselytes to the faith or not. Let me read it again. Quote, in the book of Jubilees, intermarriage with all Gentiles is prohibited, no allowances being made for proselytes. And then it gives the references out of the book of Jubilees and other places. Continuing, it says, thou shalt not give any of thy seed to make them pass through the fire to Moloch, which is translated, thou shalt not give a child in marriage to a Gentile by which the offspring is turned over to idolatry. End of that quote. One more. Peake's commentary on the Bible, 1962 and 1972, on page 249, says this, concerning verse 21 of Leviticus 18, 21 is generally interpreted as referring to a ceremony whereby children are passed through fire, possibly burning them as whole offerings. But it is curious that the prohibition here occurs among sexual matters. More than curious. Continuing, the ancient versions have cause to serve, as is in the Septuagint, and also cause to lie down for sexual intercourse in the Syriac version, whilst other Greek versions have compel by force. End of quote. So, at least there's one commentary out there that says, hey, it's a little bit odd that that verse, which appears at first on the surface to be dealing with idolatry, that's smack dab in the middle. We're starting to see that, hey, this isn't, it's not out of place at all. It's all dealing with sexual prohibitions. Now, with these witnesses in mind, and with what we've discovered, specifically about the phrase passed or passed through, and with Deuteronomy 20's association of this sin with whoredom or of some sort, and especially in light of the fact that Leviticus 18 is all about sexual perversions of some type, I think you'll agree that verse 21 fits perfectly in Leviticus chapter 18 with the rest of what's being said there, and is instead condemning forbidden lineage relationships and also miscegenation or interracial relationships. And, of course, this is not the only place that such is found in the Bible. Now, if you accept this as biblically correct, I should warn you that this is not a popular position or doctrine in this politically correct day and age in which we live. It will not win you any popularity contest, I guarantee you. But let me ask you, did you become a Christian to be popular with the general populace, or to be popular, to be right with your God? Do you want to be PC, politically correct, or do you want to be BC, biblically correct? Well, in a politically correct society, biblically correct is usually not popular. But let me remind you, let the Apostle Paul remind you of what he wrote to the Romans in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Whereas there's that saying, while in Rome, do as the Romans do. Paul said, forget that. You do just the opposite. Because in Romans 12, 1 and 2, he says, I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. While in Rome, do as the Romans do. Paul says, no, do not be conformed by the Romans. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that you may prove what the will of God is, as found in His Word, as found in His laws, as found in this case in Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 21. That which is good, acceptable, and perfect. Is the Bible is the world today, our politically correct society going to say that what I just shared with you is perfect, acceptable, is good? No, they're going to say just the opposite. But if it's in God's Word, and it's in His law, then it is perfect, and it is acceptable, and it is good. Moreover, as the Apostle Paul once stated, have I become your enemy for having told you the truth? Well, for those who hate the truth and who therefore interpret the truth as hate, they will consider me their enemy, and in fact, they will distort and they will twist what I just shared with you as being hateful, racist, and white supremacist. But what I just shared with you from the Scriptures, although specifically pointed toward Israel, but nevertheless, what I just shared with you from the Scriptures is not just good for the white race, but it's best for all of the races. As I've shared with you on other occasions, which position demonstrates more love and genuine concern for the other races? The position that promotes the amalgamation of all the races, which eventually destroys the purity of each race and their separate cultures? Or the position that promotes the preservation and the perpetuation of each race as Yahweh created them? It's so simple. And yet, the world hasn't figured that out. Now, for anyone who might think that I'm overstating the position of miscegenation or amalgamation and therefore the ultimate eradication and extinction of the different races as a result of miscegenation, let me share with you some recent newspaper headlines in this regard. And let me share with you just the headlines, because I want to emphasize those at this time, and then we'll come back and I want to read some of the quotes from these two articles. For example, if you think I'm overstating it, that it eventually destroys the different races, here is from the Winnipeg Free Press, Tuesday, May 6, 1997, an article that is entitled, listen to this, especially the second part of it, Tiger Woods' description of himself says it all. The future is light brown. By Gwen Dwyer, who is a London-based independent journalist. And let me come back to that in a minute here. Let me provide you now with the other one. Written about the same year. San Ramon Valley Times. Well, San Ramon, I would guess, is California. On November 2nd, 1997. Article entitled, Working Toward One Race. End of quote, or end of that title, by Stephen Magaganini. Now, I'll come back to that one. Let's go back to this first one. Winnipeg Free Press, Tuesday, May 6, 1997. Tiger Woods' description of himself says it all. The future is light brown, by Gwen Dwyer. Gwen Dwyer, by the way, is a man, not a woman. Quote, let me just share some of the quotes from this. Quote, just under three-quarters of the present American population, 73.1%, is classified as non-Hispanic white by the United States Census Bureau, but within 50 years, it predicts, white Americans will be barely half the population, 52.8%. 13.6% of Americans will be black, about the same as now. Asians will double to 8.2%, and most of the rest will be Hispanic. The U.S. Census Bureau is almost certainly wrong. The man who has it right is Tiger Woods, the 21-year-old golfer who electrified the United States by winning the Masters tournament and then outraged practically everybody by announcing on the Oprah Winfrey Show that he does not see himself as black, but as Kabbalah-Nasian. It's a word that describes what may be the largest American race by 2050, a mixed race group in various shades of light brown that combines the genetic heritage of most major groups on the planet. Canada promises to be an even more comprehensive mixture, and Australia and even Britain are moving in the same direction. Woods made up the word Kabbalah-Nasian because he had no word to describe himself. End of quote. Those are very telling words that really speak for themselves. He had no word to describe himself. It's really sad. Going on from that point, he says, his father had one white, one native Indian, and two black grandparents, and his mother was half Chinese and half Thai. Quote within a quote, growing up, I came up with the name I'm a Kabbalah-Nasian. End of quote, Woods explained, a mix of Caucasian, black, Indian, and Asian. End of that part of the quote. Later in the same article, Dwyer continues, he says, in America, the racial walls are breaking down. Only 4% of United States marriages are interracial, but that bald figure conceals a huge generational shift. In the 40s and 50s, less than 2% of black men married white women. In the past decade, the figure has soared to nearly 10%. End of quote. Now, is that just a white-only problem that we're talking about there? And of course, this particular author doesn't see it as a problem at all, but it's a problem. But is it just a white-only problem? Well, not at all. It's worse for the other races. He continues later. He says, quote, other non-white Americans who do not suffer the special prejudice that weighs on African-American descendants of former slaves are now marrying out at a staggering rate. Some 60% of Asian-born Americans in their 20s marry somebody of another race. And nearly 70% of Native American Indians under the age of 25 are doing the same. Quote within a quote, in recent years, the proportion of both men and women from all racial groups who marry out has increased. End of quote within a quote. Concluded University of Michigan demographer Reynolds Farley in a study published last month. End of quote. In other words, not only is the white race being destroyed through miscegenation, but so, in a much more alarming rate, so are the Asians, American Indians, and of course others as well. Mr. Dyer then says these words, quote, the melting pot, after saying all of that, he then says, the melting pot is finally working, even in the United States. End of that quote, end of what I'm quoting from that article. In other words, Mr. Dyer is for the melting pot concept. I never thought about this before, but think of the whole idea, melting pot. You know, you're all melted down. You know, whatever you put in the pot, it all becomes this melted down. Who wants to be melted down? The melting pot, but he's for the melting pot concept. In other words, he's fostering in this article a light brown future for all of us, or at least for our heritage somewhere down the road. And you notice that everywhere you look, the same is being fostered upon us. Now, we don't watch hardly any TV at all. We have a TV for news purposes and videos that we choose old videos that are still decent enough for our children to watch. But on the news, I've noticed especially in the last 4 or 5 years, how much has increased, that any time they want to have an example on anything, it's almost always now an interracial couple that they bring forward to interview, even though their interracial relationship has nothing to do with what they're being interviewed for. And you see a commercial. You see it everywhere. You see it in the host of parades. Do you ever see the host of a parade for any of the big parades that they have on TV for whatever occasions? Do you ever see that it's not a white woman and a black or some other race of some person? It is being promoted everywhere you look. This browning of America. You know, and I'm quite confident that Mr. Dyer, being under today's politically correct spell, believes that such a position that he just described, finally the melting pot concept is working even in the United States of America. That he believes that such a position is loving, compassionate, and philanthropic. But how could anyone come to such a conclusion when their position ultimately destroys the races and their cultures? And if you don't care about the white race, so be it. Then care about these other ones. Because your position destroys their culture and destroys their races ultimately as well. Let's move on to the San Ramon Valley Times, 11/2/97, Working Toward One Race by Stephen Magagini. Sacramento, quote, on a recent night, the Madrone Room of Berkeley's MLK, and you can probably figure out what that is, Martin Luther King Student Center, is overflowing with young people on a quest for identity acceptance and a new way of looking at race. They are checking out the HAPA Issues Forum, a 5-year-old organization for people of mixed race. They later define HAPA. The HAPAs, Hawaiian for someone who is half Asian Pacific Islander and half something else, include nearly every imaginable combination: Japanese, Hispanic, Argentine, Korean, African, Thai, Irish, Filipina, and Chinese Austrian. End of that description. But did you catch, he starts off the article, and did you catch, again, a very revealing statement that speaks for itself? He says, on a recent night, the Madrone Room of Berkeley's MLK Student Center is overflowing with young people on a quest for identity. Why? And looking for a new race. Why would they be on a quest for identity and looking for a new race? Because theirs has been destroyed through miscegenation. Again, I'm sure the author, Magnini, is completely oblivious to what he even wrote. But the significance of that statement escaped him. Why? Well, because he's under the spell that's been cast over our people in this regard and is being cast. Later in the same article, in a subheading entitled Interracial Couples, he goes on, quote, there are now more than 1.5 million interracial couples in America and 2 million mixed-race children, according to the census. Californians lead the way by a wide margin with 26.1% of the nation's mixed marriages, more than the next five largest states combined. He goes on, more than 70%, and he just is repeating what's found in this Canadian article now, more than 70% of American Indians, 60% of Japanese Americans, and many Californian Hispanics and Filipinos marry people of other races or ethnic groups. Their children are redefining California's culture and religion, end of quote. In other words, they have to redefine their culture and religion because once again, theirs, from either side, has been destroyed through miscegenation. Here's another telling statement and quotation from the same article. Quote, Michelle Johnson, an Alameda County High School junior, has been busting stereotypes for most of her 16 years. Quote, within a quote, I come from two strong backgrounds that have a lot of history behind them, African-American and German, end of quote, said Michelle. Michelle recently joined Multiracial Students United, which has chapters at every East Bay high school. And then she said again, quote, within a quote, they, speaking of some of the blacks, they feel I'm more white than black, she said. And then she continues, other people think I'm a thug. That's why I'm in this group, Multiracial Students United. I want someone there behind me. I wouldn't feel comfortable leaning on an African-American friend or a white friend, end of quote. Man, what telling statements that these guys wrote themselves and completely, I guarantee you, missed. Now, not only does miscegenation destroy the races and their cultures and leave their offspring in what could be described as no man's land or no race land, as in that very same quote from that young lady, but consider also the adverse negative consequences of interracial relationships just from the perspective of divorce. Whereas America's divorce rate among racially alike couples is around 50%, which is horrific enough. I've seen divorce figures, for interracial couples that range anywhere from 75 to 79% divorce rates. You're at least half again as likely to divorce. In other words, if you're married interracially, then you are racially in this day and age. Now, both are the consequence of us leaving God's laws. The 50% is, and the 75 to 79% is. They're both the result of leaving, of deserting, of running away from God and His laws in our lives. But how much worse when it comes to interracial relationships? The 1900 Century Dictionary defines miscegenation in the following fashion. Quote, miscegenation, mixture or amalgamation of races, applied especially to sexual union between individuals of the black and white races, and I should add, although not limited to that. And then it continues, individuals sometimes show a desperate desire for miscegenation, but they, listen to this last statement, but they indulge it always, it says, at the expense of a loss of the respect of both races, end of quote, which was proven and demonstrated in both of those newspaper articles I shared with you that was promoting it. How could anyone in their right mind either endorse or promote miscegenation, the mixing of the races? Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You see, our people, for the most part, are no longer in their right mind. And instead, have had this spell cast over them in this area, as well as many other areas as well. And those today who are under this spell are actually afraid of those like us who are in their right mind. Have you noticed that? They're concerned. I know of a court case that have centered in on this idea of this proliferation that I have preached of our race. I mean, they're afraid of that idea. They're afraid, those who are under the spell, who are out of their minds, if you will, are afraid of those who are in their right mind. Like those in Mark chapter 5, who were afraid of the demoniac man, not when he was possessed, remember the account? But instead, after Yeshua had healed him and returned him to his right mind. You read the account in Mark chapter 5. They were afraid of him when he was in his right mind, rather than when he was a demoniac. The biblical position of racial segregation and racial purity, listen to me, is motivated. And let me remind you, I said the biblical position. Now, some people have taken this position who are hateful, who just have this innate hate toward everybody, and especially the other races. But the biblical position of racial segregation and racial purity that God Himself promoted in His law and throughout His Word, Old and New Testaments alike, is motivated by love, not by hate. And not only for our own race, but for all the races. However, the position that promotes integration, miscegenation, and the ultimate eradication and extinction of the different races is motivated by hate, not love. Or at the best, a warped, perverted kind of quote-unquote love. You know, because for many of them, I believe that this is being promoted by many who hate. That miscegenation is being promoted by many who want to destroy the other races. But there are many who have been hoodwinked. And they think, with this perverted idea, this warped idea, that what they're doing is all out of love. But it's perverted. It's just, once again, a case of this world calling evil good and good evil. Or in this particular instance, it's a classic case of calling love hate and hate love. Let's stand. We'll close this one in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we come before You, Lord, again, that Your Word makes, and praise You for the fact that Your Word makes sense of everything, and that if we'd only return to You and Your laws and Your Word, that, Father, all that's mixed up and upside down and turned around could be turned right and upside and right side up. Father, we ask that You'd wake up our people, that You'd help us to be bold to stand in Your Word, but to do it in a loving fashion. And Lord, I pray that You would destroy the intent of those who would want to turn these words around and try to make them hateful, try to make them as if they were white supremacist or bigoted or anything like that, when in fact they're love for us and love for others as well. Let it be to Your glory that these things are preached. Let us preach Your law, Father, that someday the kingdom might be restored here on earth as it is in heaven. Let it be so. In the name of Yeshua the Christ, we pray. Amen.